This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 421 was produced on March 28, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the dollar, where it's headed both short and long term, precious metals, Bitcoin, and more. More than 80 tickets have already been sold for my live presentation on advanced nuclear technologies in Sydney, Australia on March 10th, and early bird tickets will probably have sold out by the time you hear this podcast. Full price tickets should still be available at startcon.com/nuclear, which is also linked in your research roundup. I look forward to meeting some of you in Sydney on April 10th.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, March 28th, 2024. The S&P 500 June futures contracts were up 42 basis points to 5308. The relentless bullish price action continues. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 89 basis points to 104.29, breaking out towards its February highs. The May WTI crude oil contract up 10 basis points to 81.35. Old dips keep getting bought as it trades along its multi-month highs. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The May RBOB gasoline down 184 basis points to 267. The June gold contract up 137 basis points to 2212, breaking back toward its all-time highs. Copper down 123 basis points to $4 even. Uranium up 6 basis points to 88.55. And the U.S. 10-year treasury yield down 8 basis points, trading at 419. The key news to watch this week is the Friday's core PCE price index, and next week we have the ISM manufacturing and services PMIs and the jobs numbers. This week's feature interview guest is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. Eric, why did we invite Luke back on the show as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, for as long as I've known Luke and been interviewing him here on Macro Voices, I've always said that I am personally convinced that Luke will be proven right in the end on his views that the U.S. dollar would eventually lose its reserve currency status and make a sharp move lower against other currencies. At the same time, I also was very vocal in saying, but I think Luke is way ahead of the market by several years. Well, Patrick, I think the Luke Grohman moment is finally approaching. I'm not going to say it's here yet, but where I used to say, okay, Luke will be right someday and years into the future, but not yet. Okay, I don't think it's years and years into the future anymore. I think it's coming up. So I wanted to get an update on what Luke thinks is happening and where we're headed in terms of his hypothesis that eventually the U.S. dollar will lose significant ground against other currencies as its reserve currency status is challenged.
Well, Eric's interview with Luke Grohman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. Luke, it's been quite a while. We haven't seen you since October. I'm really looking forward to catching up. It feels to me like a lot of what you said last time we had you on has started to play out. And frankly, as we go to a bigger picture, it feels to me, since I've been talking to you for I don't know how many years now, I've been waiting for the day that Luke Grohman starts to be proven right on the dollar. It hasn't really happened yet in the sense of the dollar outright, you know, failing or crashing. But boy, it sure seems like the leaks in the dam are starting to show. Do you see it that way? And if so, what do you see coming next?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me back on, Eric. You know, I was on last time we talked was October 5th of last year. And we finished up that show. I said the short run outlook dollar up, rates up feedback loop isn't going to be broken unless the Fed significantly, or unless the dollar is significantly weakened, excuse me. And to be clear, that could be the Fed or the Treasury. And then I also said, hey, oil's probably got to be weakened meaningfully as well. And so our view coming out of that conversation was that before too long, Fed or Treasury, one way or another, are going to need to resume financing U.S. deficits. And they can call it yield curve control. They can call it QE. They can call it not QE. We're only doing this to help the resilience of the Treasury market. This isn't QE. Whatever they want to call it, that's what they're going to call it. But that's what's going to happen, is what I said. And I said, once they do that, I'd encourage people to call it the stock chart of the Argentine stock market. You know, yeah, the peso's been a disaster, but in peso terms, the stock market's up like 5x in like 3 or 4 years. And I think the same thing's going to happen here, except it'll happen in dollar terms. So, you know, dollar's not going to collapse against a peso, but it's going to be really good for stocks. It'll be good for gold. And that's when you'll see gold performance, when you'll see Bitcoin really performing. So that's what we finished up with on October 5th. And so the short term was like, okay, you've got this dollar rates feedback loop that was happening. I didn't realize how short-term short would be, to be honest. The very next day, you had the first of 7 Fed speakers over the next 10 trading days start to jawbone the dollar down. And it was like they all had received a talking points memo saying the bond market has done our job for us. The bond market has done our job for us. It was like going to church when I was a kid. It was like a chant. And 2 weeks later, we wrote a report for clients that said Fed just touched off third instance of Treasury market dysfunction in past 13 months. U.S. dollar liquidity cometh. That's what the title of the report was on October 17th for clients. And I said, look, Fed has driven Treasury market dysfunction again. And right on cue, it appears the Fed's begun jawboning the dollar down. Said if we're right, we could see a repeat of the liquidity injections we saw in March of 23, September of 22, March of 20, September of 19. And a lot of investors seem offsides for that. So feels like that particular report and point, as a follow-on to what we had talked about 2 weeks earlier on the show, bore out pretty well. I said, look, this is going to be really bullish for gold, Bitcoin, oil, commodity, stocks, inflation. So not only did we get that in terms of the Fed jawboning, but then on November 1st, we had Yellen shifting issuance from the long end to the front end, much more than people expected. When you look at the effects of what Yellen did, it was effectively QE. In other words, if you look at QE historically, what happens is you have a reduction in duration issuance, you have an increase in liquidity, you have an increase in bank reserves, and you have looser financial conditions and stocks up. And so what Yellen did by shifting long into the front end, by tapping the reverse repo, same dynamics. Reduction in duration issuance, bank reserves up, financial conditions loosened, stocks up, reverse repo down. So basically, you had the liquidity increase that we thought would come whenever the dysfunction came in the Treasury market. Fast forward to today, is it the moment? I think we're getting near the moment of whatever it means. To me, what that means is ultimately the Fed is and Treasury are going to have to continue to inject dollar liquidity into elevated inflation prints, into strong nominal growth, into low unemployment, because the Fed made the mistake in 2022, of not letting inflation run higher for longer. That was their mistake this time. It's very ironic. Most investors are saying the Fed needs to be brave like Volcker. They need to be higher for longer. But because Volcker was operating with debt to GDP of 35%, today, you know, when the Fed started tightening, they had debt to GDP of 120%. It's night and day. To be brave this time like Volcker, the Fed needed to let inflation run higher for longer. Because they didn't, now they're going to deal with the consequences, which is, yes, they did generate some near-term disinflation. Inflation is off the highs, but they put the U.S. into fiscal dominance, which promises a much worse inflationary outcome. And so I think, to answer your question directly, now that the Fed has put the U.S. into fiscal dominance by virtue of its aggressive rate hiking, I think inflation is going to continue to pick up. And I think the dollar will continue to weaken in an orderly basis. You know, I don't think it's going to be chaotic. I think on an orderly basis between now and the election, and then we'll see what happens after the election.
Luke, one of the challenges of macro investing is you have to interpret multiple trends happening on top of each other. And something that kind of baffles me in all this is when we spoke in October, that was just 2 days before the October 7th attacks and the beginning of the Israel-Gaza conflict. Now, normally, any kind of big geopolitical conflict like that, especially if the U.S. is involved in it, is very strongly dollar positive. Yet we really saw a very strong downtrend in the dollar beginning just after the October 7th attacks that took us down to right around Christmas time was when the dollar bottomed. So it seemed to me like even in the beginning of a new geopolitical escalation, we were seeing that dollar weakness. That really stood out to me as unusual. Am I missing anything? Is there something about this conflict that would not have been inherently dollar positive?
No, I think you're not missing anything. To me, any conflict in theory is going to be dollar positive. I think there were two things worth noting within that. Number one, the Treasury dysfunction really kicked into high gear around October 6th, which is to say the move, a volatility index broke above 135, I think, which was the point that Harley Bassman had said the year before is when the Fed has lost control of the bond market. And historically, like I said, we've seen five times since 2019, any time Treasury volatility gets too high or starts to dysfunction, dollar liquidity is applied very rapidly by either the Fed or Treasury or both. And so I think factor number one is that the Treasury volatility that was going critical on October 6th required an immediate U.S. policymaker response, which it got first in that Fed jawboning over the next 2 weeks, and then with Yellen shifting issuance to the front end and bringing the reverse repo balances to bear to finance deficits. I think those two factors dominated the dollar positive dynamics that may have, that would have normally, I think, manifested during such a conflict. The other thing I think that may have been a factor, and I think continues to be underappreciated, is that on November 15th, President Xi flew to San Francisco and met with President Biden. And in my view, there is a significant non-zero chance that some version of the bones of a San Francisco accord to weaken the dollar were agreed to by those two. You can see the dollar weaken after that meeting. We know multiple high-level Treasury meetings where Treasury officials have gone to Beijing to start this year. We know that the conversations that have been leaked regarding the topics of those meetings are in no small part reference to trying to prevent the Chinese from dumping cheap goods onto global markets, which is to me really interesting because most conversation around the yuan is when is China going to devalue the yuan? But if the United States is talking to China about preventing cheap Chinese goods from hitting the market, the United States would not be talking to China about a cheaper yuan. They would be talking to China about making the yuan more expensive. In other words, revaluing the yuan higher against the dollar down, which is what the U.S. needs to improve Treasury market functioning and to make reshoring more economic, et cetera. Anyway, so I think those two factors of the Treasury market was in a very acute state on October 6th, as measured by the MOVE Index, as measured by the fact that as of October 6th, the TLT, the long bond ETF, was down 20% in a quarter. And in my opinion, I mean, others may think differently, but in my opinion, if you have an asset that drops 20% in a quarter, especially one as big as the long bond, that's a crash. The Treasury market crashed in the third quarter. So you had a Treasury market crash that needed instant dollar liquidity as of October 6th. And then starting November 1st, you had Yellen obviously help with address that. But then this November 15th, Xi-Biden meeting in San Francisco, I think may have been much more important for the dollar going forward than I think consensus at this point has ascribed to that meeting.
Now, as I look at the chart now, the narrative doesn't really make sense to me because at first I see after we spoke and despite the fact that we were entering this conflict with Gaza, we saw the dollar moving down sharply, exactly as you anticipated that it would. That lasted through Christmas. Then you see, starting just after Christmas, this what looks to me like a rebound or relief rally. And I sort of think, okay, so we came down quite a bit from 106 and change down to about 100 to get back up for a bounce back, a dead cat bounce to retest 104, which has been a key technical level for years now in the dollar index. Well, that made sense. And sure enough, 104 only lasted for a day or two. Then we started trading back down towards 102. And I'm thinking, okay, that was just the dead cat bounce. We're headed back down from here. But just in the last 2 weeks, since the beginning of March, we're right back up to 104 again. And just in the last couple of days, we're recording this on Monday, so it was a few days before our listeners will hear it. We just on Friday closed above 104, back below it at the end of the day on Monday. So it seems like we're right back up there again. Are we going to see further strength before this continues to play out further to the downside? Or maybe what I should be asking is, did I correctly interpret your prognosis that we were headed still considerably lower than 100, which is what we tested back around Christmas time?
I think we're ultimately headed lower. I think it's in everybody's interest for the dollar to be weaker. It's in America's interest. It's in China's interest. It's in Japan's interest. It's in Europe. It's in everybody's interest. And that's because there's so much dollar denominated debt outstanding. A decline in the dollar increases global economic activity because it makes global dollar denominated debt easier to service. It makes global balance sheet capacity to buy more treasuries. It increases that balance sheet capacity, which the U.S. needs. It makes the dollar more competitive. It makes it easier and more stimulative to reshore the industrial base, which we have begun, but need to be moving much faster on. I think ultimately the deal to be had, or the deal, the bones of the deal, is something along the lines of what we agreed to with Japan in the 80s, right? It's when Japan was beating us up in the 80s, there's a lot of people that say, well, China's going to be the next Japan. Okay. And in the mid-80s, the dollar went from 166 at the peak to 85 2 years later. A big part of how the U.S. sort of undid Japan was massively weakening the dollar. And that's sort of peak dollar, right? So even if you take 120 to 85 over an 18-month period, still an enormous decline in the dollar. Obviously, that was agreed to at the Plaza Accord in September of 85. But that dollar moved down, started in February of 85. So somebody leaked it a full 6-7 months in advance that, okay, they're starting to talk about weakening the dollar. Same thing here. The dollar peaked at 114 in September 22 after Yellen went to the IMF, I guess it was early October of 22, and Bloomberg reported that the number one topic of conversation was the dollar. Our allies were saying, what are you doing to us? You're killing us. Japan, certain European allies, et cetera. And she came out of that meeting, and immediately the dollar weakened meaningfully. She ran down the TGA aggressively. The dollar weakened by a good 30% on an annualized basis. I guess 114 to 102, 103, if I remember right, over the next 4 months. And that was sort of a jumpstart of the economy, stabilized the treasury market, stabilized asset markets, kind of kept everything from getting much worse than it was otherwise going to be in September. So I think what we've seen is, well, what we're seeing in real time is a conversation between the U.S. and China, perhaps, around a San Francisco Accord to weaken the dollar. And I think the deal on offer, the deal that makes sense, is we weaken the dollar. We coordinate with China to weaken the dollar. Maybe Japan gets involved as well, which may tie into some of the rate hikes and the ending of yield curve control. Who knows? But we weaken the dollar, notably, and we allow China to buy oil from the Saudis in yuan. Recall there were yuan swap lines signed between the Saudis and Chinese late last year. That way, when the dollar weakens, the rising dollar price of oil doesn't break China as it otherwise would, because they can print yuan for oil. With the corollary that they will buy more treasuries as the dollar weakens, which helps us, and that the Saudis will not recycle any yuan into Chinese government bonds. It'll have to go into Chinese goods or into gold. And I think that's a potential deal on offer. I don't know. It's speculation. It's informed speculation. That's what I think would make sense. And I think ultimately is in the interest of the United States and of everybody else to have a managed decline in the dollar over the next 9 to 12 months.
Let's talk about how this has transmitted to precious metals, because what's kind of fascinating to me is, despite the fact that I think you've got the dollar story right, and we did see some strength in precious metals, gold was up during that period from October. I think it was helped both by the dollar and the escalating geopolitical situation. But then, you know, gold was really kind of struggling for a while, and it wasn't until Waller's comments about shifting the focus of the Fed's activity from the back end to the front end of the curve that gold really went through the roof. I do understand the basic concept there, but, you know, $150 up on gold in just a few days, when we weren't talking about a structural change in interest rates, we were only talking about where on the curve the Fed's activities are. I wasn't expecting that. Is there more to that story that I'm missing, or how do you interpret the response of precious metals, particularly gold, to all of this activity we've been discussing?
I think it's probably a couple things to that, at least as far as how I'm thinking about it. The first, to your point, Waller's comments, I think were pretty important around the front end, shifting more to the front end. Ultimately, that is a more inflationary policy, in my view. You're getting involved in more cash-like instruments at the front end than you are at the long end. I think also right around then, in the first week of March, you had ISDA, the securities dealers, proxy for the too big to fail banks, send a letter to the Fed, the FDIC, and the Officer of the Control of the Currency, the OCC, asking for a permanent exemption to bank SLR, supplementary leverage ratio calculations for treasuries. In other words, the banks were asking the Fed, the FDIC, and the OCC to re-grant them a power they had for just a limited basis, a limited period of time from April of 2020 to April or May of 2021. So basically, bank SLR exemption for treasuries. It sounds really technical. Here's what it is. It gives the banks to buy an unlimited, infinite amount of treasuries with no capital requirements. It is QE done through the banks. That's it. And to me, I think that has at least as much to do with the jump in gold as Waller's comments. For two reasons. Number one, the fact that the banks are writing this letter tells you that they're starting to choke on treasury supplies. They need relief. And number two, the fact that they're asking for this, pretty much everything the big banks have ever wanted, the Fed gives them eventually. And then you also had Powell, to that end, talking his testimony right around that same time about basically revisiting the Basel regulations. And in fact, Bloomberg reported exactly that, that the big banks had won a major victory on Capitol Hill by deferring these capital requirements. So yes, I think part of it was Waller, and I think that was important, but I think married as well with the banks saying, we want a permanent exemption for treasuries to our SLR calculations. That means the banks, they basically borrow at zero and they can buy treasuries at 5.25 at the front end and 4.25 at the back end. And so then you go, well, how many treasuries would the banks buy at five, you know, if they fund at zero and can buy them at 5.25 or 4.25, whatever, along the curve? And the answer is like a lot, right? It's a very nice little margin, net interest margin, when you're funding at zero and you're raising it at that level. So I think that may, those two factors combined in the context of what we talked about to start the show, which is they're going to have to do some sort of liquidity, and I don't care what they call it, it's QE. This is not QE, it's just QE through the banks. It's, if you give the banks a permanent exemption to SLR for treasury, it's QE through the banks. That's it. And that's fine. It is what it is. And that leads to a very obvious set of investment choices, which is gold's going to do well, Bitcoin's going to go to the moon. And you can kind of see what those, you know, if you run a even long bond has been fine, but not relative to sort of everything else. And so when you look at the S&P 500 over TLT, over the long bond, like the chart just began exploding higher at the end of 22 when the dollar peaked and rolled over. When you look at the S&P industrials over TLT, same chart. Gold over TLT, same chart. XOP, the oil service names over over TLT. Same chart. PAVE, which is a industrial infrastructure ETF over TLT. Same chart. So to me, it is really just sort of this in the stock market, this Argentina with U.S. characteristics playbook. Like, we have a fiscal problem. It has gone acute. And it went we had our fifth episode of Treasury Dysfunction in 4 years in September. They sort of did some short-term stuff to kick the ball into earlier this year. And then I think Waller and the machinations around whether it's a bank SLR exemption for treasuries or other changes to the Basel rules, you kind of get an idea how the Fed and others are leaning, which is it's going to have to make it easier and cheaper for the banks to finance the government at really, really cheap rates. And I think that's what we're not only what we saw in gold, but I think it's what we're seeing in Bitcoin and what we're seeing in markets really on a daily basis, it seems like now.
Let's go a little deeper on Bitcoin, because even us coin skeptics have to admit the size of the move on Bitcoin was so much bigger on a percentage basis than it was in gold. Is that just because there's a generational change in everybody's favorite speculative asset for this stuff? Or is there more to the Bitcoin story that's independent of monetary policy that's been driving this rally?
I think it's, Bitcoin's obviously way smaller than gold, right? The market cap of Bitcoin is whatever, 1.4 trillion right now, give or take. Gold's is nearly 10 times that. I think that's part of it, right? So it's a much smaller asset base. Dollars are trying to squeeze into, capital's trying to squeeze into. And so I think the moves on the upside and downside have been disproportionate. I think the other thing is Bitcoin does not have nearly the financialization that gold has. In other words, you've got historically all this unallocated gold centered in London, and you've got much bigger gold futures markets, much more sensitivity to rates as a result historically. And to your point, you can see in the flows, there's been more flows of, generationally, and Western investors in particular follow performance. We're culturally, we are momentum chasers. We don't buy assets that don't go up. And if we have two assets going up, Americans will almost always buy the one that's going up faster. And so it does have some momentum that feeds on itself. It is partly a generational issue. And so I think it's sort of a little bit of all of the above.
Luke, let's talk a little bit more about these geopolitical conflicts, both Ukraine and now Gaza. How do they play into your overall thesis in the dollar moving forward? Because as you said earlier, I think we agree that there's generally a trend that these kinds of geopolitical conflicts are dollar positive. As far as I can see, these geopolitical conflicts are not ending anytime soon. It looks to me like they're getting worse. That would tend to be not necessarily a disagreement with your down dollar thesis, but it's another macro overlay which maybe neutralizes it at least for a while. Is that how you see it? And or how do you interpret the geopolitical outlook and what it would mean for your dollar thesis?
I think it's always a risk, right, that if you get a severe escalation, particularly given that what we're really talking about here are proxy wars between the U.S. and NATO against Russia, and then also the U.S. vis-a-vis China in some way. However, war is inflationary. It's always inflationary. And in the fiscal situation in which the U.S. is in, the U.S. doesn't really have a choice. It wants to win wars. It wants to support its allies. It wants to pay its boomers to make sure they vote for the right people in November. And it wants to, fight inflation by raising rates. The problem is that raising rates is inflationary when debt to GDP is as high as you reprice interest, and you're basically pumping $1 trillion in interest into the economy, which is no different than pumping $1 trillion in stimmies in, 4 years ago under COVID. So something's got to give. And I think ultimately it's going to be nominal GDP and inflation. And ultimately, we saw last fall that there is a rate at which the U.S. Treasury market at the long end starts to go sideways. And on the 10-year, that was around 5%. And so if we continue with that as our working assumption that above 5% drives a Treasury market crash at the long end, and that is simply not going to be abided for domestic economic and geopolitical reasons, then we can kind of say, all right, the release valve is going to have to continue to be the dollar. That's not to say it's going to crash, but I think it's going to continue to, the more we're involved in these conflicts, the more that should put downward pressure on the dollar. And you know, to the extent they do heat up in a measured manner, you know, you saw Putin today tell Russian oil producers that he wants production cut to 9 million barrels a day by June. And, you know, who knows? Maybe that's simply the marking to market of the damage done by these Ukrainian drones in Russia. I don't know. At the end of the day, the oil market doesn't care. If Russia is going to take down oil production, oil is going to go up. If oil goes up, you know, that's another inflationary impulse. And again, in the short run, if that causes rates to go up, that can provide support for the dollar. But we know there's a rate at which the treasury market dysfunctions. And when the treasury market dysfunctions, the dollar liquidity comes very, very quickly. And so I think it's much more, I don't know that unless there's a huge escalation, you know, rather than sort of a measured escalation, I think it's more just more of the same of, you know, you'll have these sort of what we've had since September 2022, which is, okay, dollar hits 114, goes down, bounces back up, then it goes back down, then bounce back up, and it's sort of lower lows, lower highs. That's, I think, the war and geopolitical picture as it stands now fits into that, in my view.
Luke, the other trend that is on the horizon, or I should say upon us now, because it's just over 6 months away, is the presidential election. How do the various potential outcomes of the presidential election bear on your dollar thesis?
To me, I think they're broadly supportive of a weaker dollar in an organized manner. Because when I look at what Trump did when he was in office was effectively kick off a move toward U.S. industrial policy, which is inflationary and weaker for the dollar, all else equal, bigger deficits, etc. When I look at what the Biden administration is doing and has professed to do, Jake Sullivan and others, is running industrial policy. And so to me, I think there's some difference in the industrial policy. I think Trump would be more likely to classic fossil fuel, old school industrial policy. And I think Biden would continue with this green industrial policy, which I don't think is necessarily the right thing to do, but I think they're going through with it anyway. So, but when I take a step back and I look at it, I get industrial policy with a guy who's kind of boorish at times, or I get industrial policy with a guy who's kind of senile at times. But either way, I'm going to get industrial policy, which to me, I think is ultimately supportive of a lower dollar over time. Again, not a dollar crash or anything, but just continued organized managed decline in the dollar in support of that industrial policy that both candidates seem to want to pursue in slightly different directions.
Luke, let's translate the macro views that you've expressed so far in this interview into portfolio construction guidance. I'm guessing, based on what you've said, that you're probably long both gold and Bitcoin. Why don't we start by confirming that, and then maybe tell us where the other trades are that you see.
Yes, I really like Bitcoin. I really like gold. I think they are going to continue to do well. In terms of other things, I really like electrical infrastructure related industrials. Again, because I don't care, they're generation agnostic. I don't care if it's nuclear generation or coal generation or solar generation. I don't care. They just need the wires and the equipment, etc. And so I have some investments there. I hear the open field running and electrical infrastructure. It's wide open field running. I mean, you're out 2 years on electrical generator, or excuse me, on transformers, electrical transformers just now. And that's before we really get into the electrical transition or more industrial policy. I like broad U.S. industrials. I think XOP, sort of the oil services, will continue to be fine. I don't want to be short long bonds outright, simply because it's entirely possible if we do get the bank SLR exemptions that the banks start funding at zero to buy treasuries, which they could theoretically buy infinite amounts of. That's good for rates. So it was really interesting to me to see Biden last week or 2 weeks ago say, "Hey, I bet your rates are going to come down." I think it's really interesting because my guess is they didn't sit down with Biden, given what sort of I've seen of his mental state at times, and tell him all about bank SLR exemptions for treasuries and the Bank of International Settlements talking about the use of bank balance sheets for monetary policy and macroprudential policy and Chris Waller wants to shift to the front end. I highly doubt someone sat down with Biden and ran through all that. They probably sat down and said, Mr. President, we're putting in policies that are going to make rates come down. And that's what he said on CNBC 2 weeks ago. So that's why I say I don't want to be short long bonds outright. I just kind of think they're like, eh, you know, I would be underweight them from a standpoint of, if I'm right on that view of what we've discussed here, I think it's going to be really good for nominal GDP growth. I think it's going to be really good for inflation. I think inflation is going to continue to pick back up. I don't think it's good for the dollar, but not disastrously weak for the dollar, just sort of down in an orderly basis. And that's really good for global growth. So that's, I think, a really good setup for assets broadly. And then it just comes down. So I say I want to be underweight bonds. They are a very suboptimal way to play. You know, even if yields come down, they're not going to go up nearly as much as I think a lot of these other assets that I own that we just talked to before will benefit from those trends.
Tell us your views on commodities generally and specifically on copper vis-a-vis your earlier comments about electrical infrastructure.
I like copper. I think you need it. And so I think it's a good secular hold. Commodities broadly, I think we're in the very early stages of gold re-becoming an oil and commodity currency, which is to say, there's a lot of people that will say, well, the BRICS, there's never going to be a BRICS currency and nothing's ever going to replace the dollar. And I would say, you're right, and you're right. The BRICS currency is going to be gold, and what's going to replace the dollar at the reserve level is gold, and it is replacing treasuries. It has for 10 years. I think what we're watching in early stages in real time is gold re-becoming an oil currency, and gold is much smaller than oil and commodity markets. So I think, you know, not even I think, if you call up the chart of gold over oil or gold over the CRB commodity index, you know, since Russia, the world's biggest oil exporter or energy exporter, excuse me, began reserving large amounts of gold in 2008, the price of gold denominated in the CRB index is up almost 4x. And I think that trend will continue over time. You know, any given month or whatever, it can reverse. But I think over time, gold is going to continue to rise against every commodity. It will probably, in coming as the BRICS roll out more of their intra-BRICS trade, I think gold being used as their neutral reserve asset, as the quote unquote BRICS currency, means that the price of gold will go up faster than commodities do in dollar terms, right? So the gold to CRB ratio, while up 4x since 08, I think it will rise at a faster pace than that over the next 15 years and probably shorter than that.
Let's talk about energy next. You know, it seems like on one hand, we've got increasing spare capacity in the oil market, so not a whole lot of reason to get bullish until you consider, boy, who knows what direction these geopolitical conflicts are going to take next, and you know, anything might be possible.
Yeah, I continue to think we're in a regime of peak cheap oil, which is not to, you know, which is say we're not running out of it. However, we're going to need elevated prices to keep U.S. oil online, simply because shale is so price sensitive and it declines so quickly if you shut it off and price falls far enough. We can look back to 2019 or 2020, excuse me, when we shut down a bunch of production with COVID. We got oversupplied, price got too low. It took 4 years. Late last year, finally, U.S. oil production overtook its prior peak in 2019. Geopolitically, that's really important because if oil prices are allowed to fall low enough, sustainably enough, such that the U.S. starts to shut down swaths of shale long enough that U.S. production rolls, we have no credible ability as a nation to raise production for 2, 3, 4 years. And said another way, that means we will, as a nation, have ceded the global oil market to Russia and to Saudi. And so I think it is the oil market in the short run is increasingly politicized from the standpoint that geopolitically, it's in the U.S.'s interest not to let oil fall much below $70 a barrel. And so I think we would do everything we could to prevent that. And I think it's also in the U.S.'s interest to prevent it from going too far above 90 a barrel, simply because we saw last fall once oil hit $85, we saw oil importing U.S. creditors being forced to sell treasuries to buy dollars to buy oil. Japan in particular, China to a lesser extent. And so over 90 is bad for the U.S., under 70 is bad for the U.S. And so for me, I look at oil, I think oil will probably continue to kind of be a range-bound commodity, 70 to 90. And it gets good for XOP, right? Because they got to run harder and harder to kind of keep the production up. And I think it's good for that gold to oil ratio continuing to rise, as I mentioned, secularly, as more oil basically gets settled in gold instead of treasuries or US dollar assets. But in terms of oil itself, I don't have a strong view. I don't think it's about to run away, and I don't think it's about to crash. I think we're going to be range bound 70 to 90, you know, for the next 6 months, 9 months at least till the election.
Well, Luke, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Forest for the Trees, what the website is, URL, how they can follow your work.
We connect dots for our clients in a unique manner, trying to identify ways that our clients can make money. So for more information, they can find out, check out our website, fftt-llc.com. You can also look up my X handle. I always call it a Twitter handle. Sorry, Elon. My X handle is at Luke Groman. LukeGroMen.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Luke back on the show. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Luke's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's start by covering crude oil and the EIA inventory.
It was a week of builds, Patrick, with crude oil printing a 3.2 million barrel build, Cushing, Oklahoma building 2.1 million barrels, gasoline building 1.3 million barrels, distillates was the only drawdown on the board, drawing down 1.2 million barrels for a net petroleum build of 3.3 million barrels. U.S. production held steady at 13.1 million barrels, unchanged, and that's after plateauing at 13.3 million barrels, which is also the same level it plateaued at before the pandemic began. Prices are holding over $80, the round number resistance level, as well as the short-term moving averages, despite the inventory builds. But they're still taking their time in terms of the rally not really having a whole lot of juice behind it, and that's consistent with the view that the market is tightening slowly, but plenty of spare capacity in the Arab states prevents a really big rally from taking off from here.
While oil's been relatively range-bound for the last week or two, you know, when we look at this chart on page two, we can see that it's clearly been accumulated over the first quarter of the year. Higher highs, higher lows, sustained price action above 50-day. And while there are spare capacity and all sorts of things that suggest that oil doesn't have a huge upside, I also think that there's a lot of people positioned on the wrong side of this trade, which could create a short-term short squeeze. I think at minimum, we could see $85 on the upside. But if the short squeeze happens, we could see the 90 handle on crude. I don't think that's going to be sustainable up there, but it will fit the narrative of that trade range that Luke alluded to in the interview. We get up to 90 and then trade back down to 70. And I think that right now in the short term, with least way the price action continues, I think higher for oil here makes a whole lot of sense. So let's move on to equities. I want to get Nick involved in the conversation. Nick, what levels are you watching on the S&P?
Yeah, Patrick. So right now the spot price on SPX is approximately 5250. We have an implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX of 110 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 5360 and the lower implied move is 5140. Right now, I'm inclined to think we see a bit of a holding pattern until the April OPEX. Key resistance is currently at 5250 with key support at 5200. And I think we kind of sit in this narrow range over the next couple of weeks until that OPEX passes by.
You know, on page four, Nick, I have the S&P 500 chart with the 50-day moving average, but really I should have even put the 20-day moving average on there, because what's amazing is that this rally's been so relentless that it hasn't violated the 20-day moving average once on any sustained basis since the November breakout. And it just really shows that the bulls remain in control. Higher highs, higher lows, price action in that favor. The next measured move, if they can break this to a fresh high, the measured move is up to 5,400. And I personally think that the fact that we got up to this level without the rally being checked, it's a big surprise to me, but it doesn't change my bigger view, which is that while the bulls remain in control of the price action and the trend is definitely your friend, I still believe the upside is marginal at this moment before some sort of corrective pattern comes in. And because of the level of complacency and the amount of people that had to buy into this rally, I think from a reflexive perspective, a correction of at least 500 S&P points is going to inevitably come. But the fact is we've been waiting for some sort of technical trigger to show that a sell cycle has begun, and we're almost finished the first quarter of the year and not one has appeared. It'll be really interesting to see what happens in those first few weeks of April. And nonetheless, let's move on to the NASDAQ. What are you watching on the Qs?
So right now, a spot price on Qs is approximately 445. We have an implied move of 13 points for the April monthly OPEX. And right now, the upper implied move is 458 and the lower implied move is 432. We have key resistance right now at 450 and key support at 430. Again, as I said in past weeks, I'm not so bullish on tech right now. I'm more so bullish on the small caps, and I'm selectively bullish on certain names in big tech right now, namely Apple and Google. Otherwise, I'm pretty much waiting again in a holding pattern until the monthly OPEX passes by, and thereafter we have the FOMC, which should cause some volatility.
What's interesting, Nick, with your idea of the April OPEX is it also will line up with the pig in the python moment of the earnings releases and the earnings guidance being given. It'll be interesting to see whether that becomes the next inflection point as we move forward. Nonetheless, let's touch on the VIX chart on page six, but there isn't much to say here, Nick. Ultimately, the market has been rallying. Things are relatively calm and complacent, and the VIX has gotten down to a 12 handle, and that's right down to the 3-month lows, and things are pretty calm here. What levels are you watching here?
Yeah, so with the VIX at around 12 handle, we can expect intraday top-to-bottom moves of about 0.75%. Not really much has changed in the last week or so. We're seeing a lot of complacency overall. And as you mentioned previously, if we do get that pullback eventually of about 500 points on SPX, that would mark about a 10% movement to the downside, which we saw actually last year. So keep in mind, last year in 2023, we saw two 10% pullbacks, even when we finished the year up plus 26% or so. So it can easily happen where we pull back down to, you know, 4,800 from the current level, and the VIX would spike up to around, you know, 17, 18 handle perhaps. But right now, no indication at all. I think being selective in your approach as to how you ensure your portfolio as to, you know, expiration date wise on your purchasing of puts, as well as the strategy you're using, you know, put spreads versus straight puts, for example, is very, very important. But right now, insurance is very, very cheap. And it would be wise to perhaps either take some off the table if you're overly long or if you want to hedge your portfolio overall. Now, moving on to page seven, we have the US dollar index. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
Well, we had two consecutive closes over 104 on the Dixie on Tuesday and Wednesday. If that was it and it stops here, okay, fine. This is a logical place for a top. It's where the last cyclical top was if we're just in a consolidation pattern. But if we get a daily close over 104 and a half or a little higher than that, whatever the previous high was from a month or so ago, that would suggest that we might be starting a new leg even higher. So is this a sideways consolidation or are we starting a leg higher? That's really the question to ask. And the answer, at least a clue to it, should come from whether or not we get a daily close over 104 and a half in coming days.
Eric, I actually think that this dollar strength is something that can't be ignored. The euro is breaking down below 108. You have a yen that is right along the US dollar yen that's up along the 152 level. And if all we need is a little push off the cliff and we've got ourselves a US dollar bull trend, this, in my mind, it has all of the makings of a short-term breakout. And not many people are talking about this. Now, does that mean that there's a big extraordinary run where we're going to see 110 or 114 on the dollar index? No, or at least too early to speculate. But at this stage, if we see this continue, there's no reason why we ain't retesting the October highs near 107 on the upside. And I think that this is the chart to watch.
And moving on to page 8, we have that gold futures chart, which is making new highs. What are your thoughts here?
Gold is performing incredibly well. It's holding up and just printed a new all-time high close on Wednesday, and that's despite the strengthening U.S. dollar. That strength, despite dollar strength, portends more strength to come. I think we are headed at least to 2,300. That's probably a good place for the market to take a breather and retrace a little bit, but ultimately, I think we're probably headed higher than that. 2,725 is the target for the long-term cup and handle pattern. I don't know if that's going to happen this year, but I think that by the time we get to the election in November, we're going to be higher than just 2,300. Let's see what the market gives us.
Eric, I have to agree with you. The fact that the U.S. dollar is strong and looking like it's breaking out and gold just continues higher, there has to be something to that. I mean, the targets from last week when you and Ole Hansen were talking about 2,300 are still very much in play. I'm a little bit surprised at the strength, but at this moment, there's no reason not to remain bigger picture bullish. The bigger question in my mind, is this the breakout that sees those really big bull impulses that could see 2,700 plus, or is this simply just a quick move and then we're going to spend many months consolidating once we hit the upper boundary of a short-term range? Nonetheless, the pattern of higher highs, higher lows and is still in place and the bulls are in control, so we have to play that way. I wanted to, though, move on to page 9, where I just wanted to touch on the silver chart, but what I did here is I put the weekly chart so I could capture at least 5 years of price action. And while gold has been trading at an all-time high, silver has yet to join the party. And so at this moment, we're going to watch closely whether or not this can actually bullishly follow through. I think silver, while it's not an asset that is actively accumulated by central banks, inevitably, as gold is moving and retail interest starts to pick up, you would think that it would start to reflect in the supply demand of silver and drive it potentially back towards $27, $28 highs that we saw a few years ago.
And on our last page here on page 10, we have the chart of uranium. Eric, I'm always interested in your thoughts.
Most of the uranium mining charts suggest that the bottom is probably already in, but the recovery off that bottom has been sluggish at best. When something really is a bottom, the market doesn't usually give you multiple chances to buy it at that level, which we did get this time. That tells me that there's still room for another leg lower, although we're not seeing it in the charts quite yet. Maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part, because I was hoping for that leg lower to buy more shares, because I'm still uber bullish long term. I think the spot market and the term market are disconnected in a way that's confusing a lot of people. Justin Hune over at UraniumInsider.com has done a lot of analysis on that. We're working on getting Justin back in coming weeks here on Macro Voices.
Eric, I generally look at it the same way you do. To me, and when I look at this chart of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, to me, it needs a legitimate breakout north of $30 to demonstrate that the bulls are actually putting together a new bull sequence and it's off to the races again. The fact that we've bounced and it's just consolidating along its 50-day moving average, to me, leaves the window open, like you're suggesting, that there could be still, you know, one more dip. But overall, even if the Sprott Physical did dip one more time, let's say a quick drop to $25, I still believe it's a compelling buying opportunity. You know, after a 9+ month run, expecting a 2 to 3 month market correction that gives back half of its gains is a very typical type of price action move. And so this doesn't change the bigger bullish picture. It's simply about just trying to size up what is clearly a mean reverting profit taking correction. How deep does it go and where does the next bull trend really begin?
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview and the chart book we just discussed in the postgame, including a link to a number of articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more. in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.